We're a bit far away from each other, aren't we?
Is that disturbing the camera?
Is that all right? Camera wise, good. Oh, well, welcome from me to you, Saviti.
Thank you very much.
And yeah, it's a special day for you today, isn't it, as well? In terms of your, it's Saviti's birthday in a sense today, in a certain sense, well, in a way, in the most important sense, because 46 years ago today, Saviti was ordained into what's now the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order.
Yeah.
So that's really, really auspicious. Yeah. Mm. Where did that happen, Saviti? Where was your ordination?
It happened in Suffolk.
Mm.
We used to go up to a place near Brandon in Suffolk, and we borrowed a cottage in the middle of a pine plantation, which was a bit weird. The pine plantation, very tightly packed trees, and there's not a very good atmosphere in the trees, but the house was nice. And David Mitra was there. Mangala, not here tonight, but anyway, a few from around here, we were on retreat, and that was where I was ordained.
Mm.
At that time, I was living in North London, and it was about 3 years before we found the London Buddhist Centre.
Mm. Good. Oh, I'm really pleased you're particularly.
I was only 25.
Wow. Well, you've had a long life in the order.
Indeed. Yeah.
So we've got this question to explore. Why do I suffer? Why do we all suffer? And I was chatting to Maitreya Banda about this a few days ago, and actually we wondered, well, in a sense, like, do we suffer? Like, here we are, living in the, the modern world. We're all, we're all fed, presumably. We're all clothed. We're all in a indoors, we're all able to come to the Buddhist centre. So what do you think? Do you think it's even true to say that we do suffer?
Well, of course, one has to think more carefully about what is meant by suffering.
Mm.
And I have to refer to Buddhist tradition.
Mm.
And I think that you could say that in Buddhist tradition, the word dukkha, which we usually translate as suffering, covers pain, insecurity or anxiety, and lack of fulfillment.
Mm.
Covers that broad range. So it covers the actual pain that we experience when our bodies are hurt, when in an ordinary way what we want is, or sorry, we're thwarted in some way or other. So it's actual suffering, dukkha, dukkha. It is the pain that is pain. So it's quite literal, ordinary, straightforward pain. Well, of course, we don't all always experience pain in that sense. And, some people are very fortunate and hardly ever suffer in that sort of way. I've been pretty fortunate in that way myself. I haven't had much of that sort of suffering so far, but there's plenty of time to go. But it may not be that we do directly suffer much in that sort of way. You know, when bricks fall on your head and that hurts, or you stub your toe, or you get some serious illness or whatever, that may not happen to you. And some people can die without a great deal of direct suffering and direct pain in that way. But it is inevitable. It's a part of life, so it will come. That's the first point when we say that life is suffering. But yes, if your own life is pleasurable and you're experiencing quite a bit of ordinary happiness and so forth, well done, good for you. You must have done something good sometime or other. But yes, I think one must be careful not to assume that when you say that sabbe sankhara dukkha, all conditioned things are suffering, that you're seeming to say that everybody coming through the door is suffering immediate pain. The second kind of suffering, which I suggest you might gloss as anxiety or insecurity, is again not necessarily full-blown anxiety in the sense that you're always worrying about what may happen next, but it's an underlying sense that however well things are going, they will end. It will end. And for the Sanskrit and Pali for this form of suffering is parinama dukkha, which parinama broadly means change. It's the suffering that comes because everything changes. So that sooner or later, whatever you like will go, whatever you don't like will come. And one has an awareness that this is the case. So there's a sense of underlying insecurity, even in one's happiness, even in the moments of great enjoyment and so forth. There's a residual underlying sense, well, how long is this going to last? You can sometimes catch yourself in that sort of mood. I don't know, anybody seen that film, The Great Beauty, which is a... Yes, I don't know whether you remember. It's an Italian film, brilliant Italian film, which starts in the middle of a sort of party with hordes of people bouncing up and down to techno music. I don't know technically what it is, but some sort of music, bouncy music. And the leading character, who's a 50-something journalist, is dancing away with everybody else. He suddenly stops. And you can see crossing his face the sense that, oh, this is not substantial. This doesn't go all the way through. So it's that sense that anybody can have at any time, and that we probably all have in a residual sense underlying, that whatever happiness we have is fragile, and that whatever whatever happiness we have, it's going to end, and some sort of pain or unsatisfactoriness is going to come. We are going to be, in the technical language, deprived of what we want, and we are going to be conjoined with what we don't want. So that's the second level of dukkha. And I think we could be pretty sure that everybody experiences that to some degree. It may not be at the front of your mind, but it's the back of your mind. It's the middle of the night sort of sense. You know, when you wake up and think, oh... The 3 o'clock in the morning, the O that you have, it's not quite there yet. But the deepest sense, I think, is the one that we can definitely say that everybody has, although we don't stop to feel it. It's there, but we're in a constant battle to stay ahead of it. And that is sankhara dukkha. The dukkha that comes from simply being conditioned, from identifying ourselves with conditioned things, identifying ourselves as a conditioned being, that inevitably means some lack of fulfillment. It's not enough. Again, for the film buffs here, Tarkovsky, oh, don't say you don't know Tarkovsky. Solaris is a wonderful film. No, not Solaris, Stalker. Wonderful film in which... there's a certain point where the leading character, I won't tell you all about it, recites a poem by Tarkovsky's father, Arseny, which has the refrain, you know, it's a beautiful life, the sun is shining, but there has to be more. And the refrain is like that, there has to be more, there has to be more. He captures exactly this underlying existential sense that whatever we've got, however good it is, it's not enough. We try to stay ahead of that, and a lot of our effort goes into sort of keeping just one step ahead of that underlying sense of unfulfillment, in a constant quest for fulfillment ahead of us. I've just done a 6-month solitary retreat, I noticed myself in that, because, you know, there's not a lot to do when it's just you. And I noticed, well, what I saw as seeking rebirth. My mind, my aspiration to create something that would be satisfying. And often the satisfaction came in the idea that it would be satisfying. Underlying that, of course, is a sense of insufficiency. So one sees oneself constantly grasping onto this and that and the other in order to stay ahead of the underlying sense of unfulfillment. It's not a psychological feeling, if you see what I mean. It's not to do with, you know, the childhood experience or anything like that. It's simply to do with being a human being identified with conditioned things, identified with your body, identified with your social and psychological identity, all of which is conditioned, it's constructed. And because it's constructed, it's restrictive. And so one feels that. I remember Bhante describing it once as, he quoted H.G. Wells talking about the Buddha and saying that he felt this dissatisfaction. And he described it as the dissatisfaction of a fine mind that seeks fulfillment. But I think we can extend beyond that and say we all of us have a fine mind. We all of us are conscious and we seek fulfillment. We seek fulfillment inefficiently through means that cannot deliver it. Like a lion sort of caged in a walking up and down amongst the bars, between the bars, and feeling a sense of what the plains would be like to lope through. So, yes, not everybody here suffers much at the level of ordinary pain. Well done, good luck. Me too. Everybody has experiences of anxiety, insecurity, getting what you don't want, not getting what you do want, having what you do want and knowing you're going to lose it, etc. Everybody has that, but usually it's softened. Some people it's very much sharpened. Most of us it's softened because the circumstances of modern life deliver satisfaction, or at least the artifice of satisfaction, in a surprisingly sufficient way. You can always go to another YouTube channel or whatever. You can quest that satisfaction. But deeper down, if we're really, really open to our own depths, there is a deep sense of unfulfillment, of this isn't enough. There has to be more. And it's not an unhappy feeling, if you see what I mean. You can be in pleasure. You can be confident, secure, getting what you want in an ordinary worldly sense, and it's still there. And that is the ultimate kind of dissatisfaction or unfulfillment. Yeah, unfulfillment is the best word that I think everybody in their finer moments, the moments of greater awareness, recognises. It's a long answer to a short question.
Yeah, I thought it might be.
Yes, there you are. Well, I know they're all here because it was billed as a frank discussion, so I'm presuming you're waiting for the revelations. Unfortunately, I've led a sheltered life.
That's good. I mean, in a way, I was going to ask you about suffering in your own life.
Yes,
but
yeah.
I could ask you about that, and I might, but possibly a more interesting question.
Well, you have a chance to complain a bit.
Yeah. Well, thinking about that third level of suffering, there has to be more. It strikes me that you've sort of answered it yourself, really, by saying in our finer moments we feel that. Almost it seems to suggest that as you carry on practicing the Dharma, one's awareness of that level of suffering will increase in a sense. Like what I'm getting at is we often think the Dharma's there to decrease our suffering, but actually what you said turns that on its head a bit, doesn't it?
Yes, of course, it ultimately means the transcendence of suffering and the resolution of the problem that underlies or the trend, the force that underlies that suffering. But I think it's inevitable that initially, as one practices and becomes a little bit more sharply aware, one becomes more sharply aware of the sense of unfulfillment. And that's good. That's good. It's not easy, necessarily. It's often experienced as sort of restlessness. I experience it like that often, as sort of itchy feet. But as increasingly, one will experience the fact that there's actually nothing you can do to alleviate it in that sort of way. You can't escape it by getting into another state, another situation, or creating another identity or another circumstance. That will not resolve it, because it's deeper and more fundamental and to do with the deep-rooted structure of one's mind and one's failure to really understand the nature of this life.
So that's really counterintuitive, though, isn't it? When one feels that, to feel that's good. Would you say?
It might do. It doesn't seem to me, but it might do.
Well, maybe I can talk about it. So often when I feel any kind of suffering. Oh. I often think, oh, I've done something wrong.
Right.
I'm not practicing properly, etc.
You know, wouldn't have been brought up as a Catholic, would you really? Oh, yes, I see, I have. A hit. Carry on.
Yeah, well, anyway, that was...
I'm in a very mischievous mood, you'll have to
put that with. Yeah, you are, well, that's what I meant by it's counterintuitive. How do we remember to remember... Yeah. That step of thinking, this is good, yeah, this is sort of dharmically
right.
good.
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing is to recognise that there are different kinds of, the different kinds of suffering have different causation, mm-hmm, if you see what I mean. So I remember once a ramble I did, probably in the days before the Ice Age, I talked about what I called a calculus of suffering, or calculus of pleasure, actually, mm-hmm, I called it. So that there's pleasures that are karmically bound, and there are pleasures that are simply to do with getting temporarily the circumstances that deliver to you a sense of ego expansion and of physical pleasure, and so on, and the sufferings that correspond to that. And then there's pleasures that come from a higher state of consciousness in which is much more satisfying, much more wholesome, and in which there's not pain in the ordinary sense, but there is pain in the sense that you know it's not enough. And then there's finally the pleasure or the pain, and then the corresponding pleasure that is to do with this much deeper layer. So I think one needs to have a much more sophisticated understanding of suffering, and to be able to recognize more clearly what kind of suffering one is experiencing. I've schooled myself to watch my suffering, mm-hmm, and my pleasures as well, because they're even more dangerous. Mm-hmm. Schooled myself to notice when I'm suffering and to identify the level on which that is coming. A very, very interesting sutta in which the Buddha describes the whole path in terms of suffering. Mm-hmm. So it starts out with him saying that, you know, I lived the life at home, but I experienced it as narrow and dusty, cramped, lacking in real satisfaction. So I went forth and lived the life of homelessness, went out into the jungle, and then, I guess, it doesn't actually put it like this, felt bored. You know, you're still restless, you're still not fulfilled, and living in the jungle is not that different from living at home. It's just in the jungle, not at home, unless you've resolved something much more deeply. So then he goes on to learn to meditate. So he gets into first jhana, enjoys that. Then he gets fed up with all that thinking, vitarka vichara. And so, you know, he sees the suffering in that. So he goes into the second jhana, and then he becomes dissatisfied with priti, with rapture. Because priti is sort of enervating, you know, all that rapture just becomes too much, leaves you exhausted. And believe it or not, I can't say exactly speak from personal experience, but I've read the books. He goes on further and further, right up to the point at which he's in fourth jhana. And then he feels, well, this is very pleasurable, very satisfying. It's not going to last. He knows that as soon as he stops making an effort, down he comes. So he sees that he must make the effort to make the final step and see what it is that keeps suffering going, the house builder, as he calls it elsewhere. Yeah. So I think one needs to learn to love one's suffering, not as a masochist, unless that's your taste, but one needs to recognise that it's a clue to where one is at, and to not merely try to evade it or escape it, because that is what we very efficiently do. We've got a whole social structure, we've got a whole structure of personality and mind that is meant to avoid the fundamental sense of dis-ease. For those of you who are interested in philosophy, that one of the most brilliant expositions of this I've seen is in Schopenhauer's The World as Will and Representation. He gives the best analysis of suffering I've ever seen. It's this sort of this underlying sense that wasn't satisfying, but the drive, the hope, the belief that there's some other set of circumstances that will not be like that. Mm. And so we live from, you know, suffering to a false hope that we can resolve it, then that becomes dissatisfying, we go on. So if we learn to spot the suffering, not to indulge in it, not to revel in it, but just to notice it and notice it, what it's telling us, what it's telling us about our experience and our orientation and expectation. So personally, I've made this into quite a focus of my practice, just keeping track of where I am in suffering, making sure that I'm going deeper and addressing the deeper and deeper aspects of suffering.
So that's really, really interesting. So I want to keep on that for a bit. So just so we really understand how we can do it as well. So say there you are on your solitary retreat, say.
Yes.
And you're feeling bored.
Yeah.
So then you think, well, what happens next? What do you actually do when you say you screw yourself in it?
Well, I would look at the boredom.
Okay.
Which means sort of not thinking about it. Mm. Don't think. Yeah. Don't ratiocinate. Don't heap another order of escape on top of it. Mm. But sort of experience it from within with an intelligent perception. I don't mean just dully, soaking yourself in it, but with an intelligent awareness, just be bored and, as it were, look into boredom, sometimes described as staring into boredom. So you just focus on it. You just say, well, this is what I'm experiencing right now. It's not wrong, it's not right, but it's a clue to something about how I am, living and how I'm using my mind, how I'm interpreting my experience. And you try to just allow that to, as it were, deepen. And you may find it very difficult. I certainly have done and sometimes still do, find it very difficult to stay with it, because boredom is not painful in an ordinary sense. It's just, you just don't want to be there. And you want something to happen. And so you try to invent something to happen. Mm. You know, so on solitary retreat, I think, I know, I'll write a book. And I know, when I come out of the solitary retreat, I will X, Y, Z, or, you know, I'll sort that person out in this way, whatever it is. Very good ideas, but you try to get away from it. So you hold your feet to the fire, and you make sure you don't escape. You know, I'm using nasty images. It's not really like that. It's just staying with it. And what one may find if one does stay with it, it suddenly sort of opens up. It's my experience. It suddenly sort of opens up into a vast space, and one may then experience something creative bubbling up, which is really not ego-driven. It's not self-driven. It seems to come from another dimension, and you may begin to feel a happiness that is not of a conditioned kind and of another order. To some degree, I'm not talking about the big B of Bodhi, but I'm talking about just a little sense of being free. You just stay with that as long as you can, and then the boredom comes back, or ideas start reasserting themselves, your mind wanders and you find yourself back in it. Just come back to it. So that for me was my principal practice, was just staying with the space, as it were. And I began to really enjoy it, mostly. Began to be amused by my mind's little acrobatics to escape, and spot them reasonably quickly. Sometimes it would take a day or so, and you suddenly oh, wait a minute, that's not going anywhere. But as time goes on, you spot it more and more quickly. So it's a question of giving yourself at some point during your day a time to just allow space to open up, which of course modern life does not permit. As soon as there's a space, out comes the mobile. You look for something to fill that space. And it's as straightforward as that. You know, coming out of that solitary retreat, I find I've still got it. I hope I can keep it, but a sort of sharper perception of what's going on around me. And I can sort of see people on the tube. They get bored. out comes the mobile, or whatever.
Mm.
And you know, I do it myself. I'm not better than them, but we need to try to make sure there's some periods when we stay with this boredom, which is really another word for the experience of sankhara dukkha.
Mm.
It's the sort of the most recognizable form of sankhara dukkha, and you just stay with it. And I hope you will stay with it with a sort of confidence that there's something the other side of it, as it were, something beneath it. So one needs still to do quite a lot of work at developing faith. One needs to do quite a bit of work to develop steadiness of mind, emotional positivity, because what comes up in that space is all sorts of bad thoughts about yourself or bad thoughts about other people. So you need all the basics that we know and love and we all have to do, the mindfulness of breathing, the metta bhavana, before that will be something you can really take up as an abiding practice. I've been practicing for 46, well, actually it's more like 50 years. And so I'm able to hold myself there. But even after all those years, it's still difficult. So to begin with, you won't be able to do that, you know, that can't be your major practice. It needs to be part of your practice, that you're letting that space open up so that you really are able to look into it. If it's too much, well, don't hold it. And particularly if you're in crisis of some kind, all these levels get mixed up. So you know, the suffering that's to do with your physical pain and the suffering that's to do with the horrible circumstances you've experienced and this deeper sense of unfulfillment that everybody has all get mixed up. And you may not be able to stay with it. Traumas get mixed up and so forth. So be sensible, but I would recommend that everybody spent at least a few minutes just literally doing nothing and allowing boredom to mature. And, you know, have a boredom app that you just look at and that just bores you. oh, yeah, I could market that, couldn't I? Yeah. Sankhara Dukkha app. Yeah.
I liked when you said it's a I liked when you said it's a clue. I wondered do you say that to yourself, or this is a clue?
Yeah, I don't do it now because it's sort of second nature. But yes, I used to do that to school myself with here is the route down.
Okay.
You know, it's the first thread of the that leads you down into the depths. Because how else are you going to find the entrance, if you see what I mean? Where is it? And sometimes you can feel that when you're trying to practice. Where the hell do I go? But you've got in your direct experience the thread that will take you there. And it's fair enough, you may not be ready to follow that through, and don't be foolish. But it gives some space, and at least get a little tug on that red thread. And know it's there. And then you've got work to do up there, as it were. But in the end, that's where it goes. So clue is important. You know this is because of the fundamental nature of things. This is me and the fundamental of nature of things coinciding.
So is boredom then the... Is that the, I don't know, the top clue or something? I'm thinking about different kinds of suffering, not just the different levels, but different ways of manifest.
Well, I think that boredom is probably the most readily identifiable, but I think probably it's the sort of thing that as an artist, as a poet, you'll experience. You like what you've produced, you think it's pretty good, everybody praises it, but you know it's not enough. What's it said that the artist should be content with his or her work, but not satisfied, or not realizing there has to be more. So in the aesthetic field, I think it's that sense. It's in the more conceptual field, it's the sense that, well, yes, that is a good grasp of the nature of things, but there's something else, there's something that eludes that. So it's in whatever field of endeavour you're working, even in friendship, you can feel, well, that's really good. We've come really close, but there's still a barrier. There's still a separation that we can go beyond. You could follow it through in every field. So a boredom is more kind of personal experience, yeah. isn't it? Where you just don't know what to do. And it's very, very common experience, especially for young people, I think. I remember being so bored as a youngster. And nobody was telling me, well done, boredom at last. And all you wanted to do was fill it. In my day, you didn't have so many opportunities. But yes, so it's experience in many different fields. And I'm just snatching out of the air some things that occur to me. But probably if you take boredom as just a sort of heading, a kind of a category, it's unfulfillment would be the category. I distinguish between unfulfillment and unhappiness. Unhappiness is more to do with not getting what you want or getting what you don't want. So it's to do with the worldly winds, isn't it? The worldly winds are blowing against you. You're getting the cold winds, the sharp, the painful winds. And so you feel unhappy. You're not where you want to be. You're not getting what you want. The world is not configured in the way that suits you. So that's unhappiness in this definition. Unfulfillment can even be there in the state of happiness, where everything is going your way. But it's not enough. And yes, I think we are not told enough that that's a good thing, because it's a clue to where real fulfillment lies.
I've been thinking over the last few days, just thinking about talking to you about this, about something Bhante said, which I think was something like in a seminar or somewhere, that an experience of suffering isn't the same as an insight into suffering.
Yes.
And I feel it, you know, what you're saying ties in with that. Could you?
Well, I remember reading about a as it happens, Vipassana teacher. I'm not saying that's all Vipassana teaching, but Vipassana teacher who made people sit for very long periods in you know, full lotus, and when they began to get pains in their legs, told them that's dukkha. Now you've got the noble truth of dukkha. It isn't. All you've got is a pain in your legs and probably need to get your circulation going before you have a serious problem. So just the fact that you are suffering does not mean that you've awoken to the truth of suffering. The fact that you're not suffering does not mean that you haven't woken to it. Suffering in the sense of pain and what I call insecurity or anxiety. It's not quite that. But so I think that's very important. So sometimes, yes, I think there can be teachers who try to make their students suffer because that will be a key to understanding dukkha. Or sometimes I'm told somebody's come to the centre and they've got a lot of suffering. That's good, because that will mean they can more easily understand dukkha. Not at all. Not at all. In fact, too much suffering makes it very difficult to see. And, you know, what we learn in Buddhism, that first of all, a degree of just ordinary, happy, healthy human, and Bhante used to say, shamatha, is a prerequisite for seeing clearly. Because the intensity of dukkha dukkha and parinama dukkha, the first two levels, is overwhelming. And, you know, you've got all the instincts to get away from it, which are very difficult to evade. So I don't begrudge anybody their efforts to escape from those kinds of suffering. And just deeply grateful that I've had a pretty happy life, or not much pain in my life in real terms.
I think that's very good. I really wanted to draw that out a bit more. It's always it's always interesting to hear that. So it's I've been on a few occasions now since you finished your 6 month solitary where you've talked about it, and it definitely, well, to my ears anyway, sounded like you yourself had a deeper insight into the nature of suffering on that solitary retreat. But seem to put all your own suffering into a completely new perspective.
But in a way, one would jolly well hope so. Otherwise, one's wasted one's time. But and, you know, I'm certainly not trying to calibrate myself against the great and the good of the Buddhist tradition. I'm just talking about my experience. I think calibration's not a good idea anyway, or external calibration's not a good idea anyway. But yes, I, as always happens when you're in solitude and you've got plenty of time, all the leftover issues came to the surface. what this person had done, what that person had said, and what, you know, the way they treated me and what I'd done, all these things sort of emerged. And which is not particularly pleasant. It's painful. And then I for some reason, I can't remember the genesis of this. No, it's escaped me for the time being. But I began to be aware of the huge suffering in the world. And I think I began to think, well, you know, this little bit of suffering of mine is nothing compared with what I see in the world around me. I've just come back from Hungary just yesterday, where I see that the condition that young Roma gypsies live under, and the huge suffering that they experience just on a daily basis. You know, like the school that our Mitras run in northern Hungary provides food for the students because they don't get adequate feeding when they're at home. And you know, like girls pregnant at 14 and with no real prospects. Nobody's got any prospects. You know, the prospect for men is jail, and for girls is just endless childbirth. And a lot of suffering connected with that. So, you know, what's my little bit of dissatisfaction because X said something nasty to me or didn't do what I wanted them to do? So it puts things into proportion in that way. But, you know, that's a bit of a step in the right direction. But then I mentioned in the retreat that you were on that I was reading some of the poetry of Edward Thomas and some of his travel writing. I think one of the greatest of English poets of the 20th century and huge influence on modern English poetry. Nature poet and very plain language. He was the first really to just use ordinary language, influenced by Robert Frost. But deep lover of nature and a very strong, acute sensitivity to the natural world and natural beauty. It's an extraordinary poetry, which is very, very moving. But he himself is a deeply unhappy man, deeply, deeply unhappy man. And in fact, at a period of his life, he used to walk around with a loaded revolver in his pocket because he just didn't know when it was going to become unbearable and he had to shoot himself. I sort of reflecting on that, this very, very fine mind, this very, very fine sensibility, far, far finer than mine, and a far more sharp and clear intelligence than mine. A deep sense of sort of sympathy and compassion for him. And a sort of sense that, oh, if only he'd found the Dhamma. Only he'd found the Dhamma or found poetry earlier, because he began to get some relief from poetry. He discovered poetry quite late in his life. A sense that, you know, even with this extraordinary genius and this very fine sensibility and very acute awareness of others, although he wasn't always able to control his behaviour in relation to others because he suffered so much, but the missing piece underneath it all. And that sort of focused me down on that as the key issue. That is the fundamental issue. The fundamental issue is this deep sense of unfulfillment, and it's being a gateway to where ultimate and final fulfillment lies. So I had a little journey of my own. I've not told it in full on this occasion, but that's the way one mind works in those sort of circumstances. You take the Dhamma and your ordinary experience and your ordinary reflections get sort of taken down by the Dhamma. But yes, it was a very strong experience, and these sort of dissatisfactions, well, these sufferings in the Parinama Dukkha sense had plagued me for a week or two. They just suddenly went because everything was in proportion. This is, as compared with this, it all is pretty irrelevant. And this is what we're finally about. And this is what the world finally needs to hear about. More of that the day after tomorrow.
Just say a little bit more. So I'm just trying to understand it. So there you were. You were really feeling for Edward Thomas. Really feeling for his existential suffering.
Yes, yeah.
And then that took you to a realization.
Yes, of course, because I've got the background of the Dhamma.
Yeah.
So that directed my attention to something deeper. So I was sort of thinking, well, this man with such acute sensibility, so fine, his intelligence and his awareness, so fine. And yet, he didn't know where to look for an answer. So I became more aware of where one does need to look, where I need to look for that answer. And that brought me into a deeper connection with that. And that then, all of this, which is actually pretty small, really, it goes into proportion. And one then sees the extent to which all of that is predicated upon self-attachment.
Okay.
This is a missing gap in what I'm saying.
Yes.
It's all predicated upon a conditioned attachment to me.
Okay.
As the central and most important person in the universe. I hope you all agree. So it sort of focuses attention on where the problem lies and where the solution lies.
Okay.
Because in the end, this sense of unfulfillment is because you've tried to get, 100 gallons into a quart pint pot. Oh, sorry, this is old language, isn't it?
I'm trying to understand the simile or the metaphor.
Well, I always get this image of like you have a big balloon and you've got to get it into a little bottle. And so you're trying to sort of squeeze it into the bottle, and as soon as you get a little bit in, another bit squeezes out.
Okay.
So you yourself, talking about 1,000 million gallons is not enough. You're the ultimate blue sky, without boundaries, without definition. Hmm. You're as wide and deep and clear as that.
Okay.
You are. It's not really that you are, but that's what is at the bottom of the back of your mind, your mind. But you're trying to fit that into a narrow self-identity. I am this. I am a, white English male of a certain class, certain kind, a certain conditioning, a certain education, certain status, etc. Which we're doing all the time. We're clinging to it. Yes, we adjust it. But we, underneath it all, believe we are something. And the boredom and the the sense of unfulfillment is the interface between that and reality. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, isn't there? There's a point at which the rubber hits the road. It's the point at which our illusions come up against reality. The illusion that we are a solid, substantial, real, abiding, eternal I, independent of experience. And that is challenged every moment of our life, but usually we stay ahead of it. So when you allow the space to open up, it becomes blindingly clear as a deeper and deeper sense of unfulfillment. But beneath that is a deeper and deeper sense of the freedom and purity that there is to be experienced. Does that make it clearer?
Yes. And, well, it sounds like, there was two things. There was your practice of allowing that deeper space to open up. But also there was your deep feeling for Edward Thomas.
Yes, that's
wasn't
true.
Wasn't it? I think why I'm interested in it, because as it happened on my long solitary trip, I also read the letters of Edward Thomas.
Oh,
poems. And, similarly felt, just the heart-wrenchingness of it. But I don't think I had an insight into...
You're right.
So I'm just trying to see what were all the ingredients. So, the ingredients.
Yeah,
as
you weren't on solitary retreat for long enough, I suspect.
I wasn't there for quite a long time. Maybe not deep enough. I think it's probably the depth. Yeah. So it seemed like it seems to me those two ingredients. There's something about that feeling when you describe the feeling for him.
Yeah, I find it difficult to say exactly what it was. There are probably other ingredients that also made it up.
Mm.
And I had been reflecting quite a bit on emptiness on the insufficiency of self-identity. And I had a strong experience on the solitary retreat of my own self-identity and this cobbled together patchwork of things that's very little of it's really to do with me. I mentioned that my nephew has been looking into the family genealogy And he discovered all sorts of things about our family that when I read about them, I thought, oh gosh, that's me. You know, there's like all my five generations of males on my father's side were engineers, Scottish engineers, and soldiers. And, you know, several of my ancestors died in the Great Wars. And that's all in me. I recognise those traits in me. And so you begin to think, what actually am I? So I was sort of up against all of that. And so I think that was another ingredient. It's difficult to say all the ingredients. And as it happens, I had been looking back at the... that's right, I'd been looking at the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which I talked about on that retreat. In preparation for that retreat, I'd been looking at that sutta, the first teaching, the so-called first sermon, where the Buddha talks about the Four Noble Truths and the truth of dukkha. So I'd been, you know, looking at what the text actually says about the different kinds of dukkha. And it goes through those three levels, although not explicitly. And so I'd been reflecting on that. So that one's reflection on the Dhamma comes into connection with one's own immediate experience and what one's mind and heart are engaged with. When one's engaged with poetry, it engages one on a deeper level. It was more his travel writing that struck me. Which is very poetic. And then all these come together, you see what I mean? So that it's a bit like the Dhamma reflection finds a grounding through these reflections, like lightning striking, and it runs all the way through one's experience. And it may have a very liberating experience. How long, I don't know, but at least for that, for the rest of that retreat, I was free of those particular preoccupations and sufferings. No doubt I'll accumulate some others in time, but I'm trying not to.
So we've just got a few minutes to go. I was just wondering if you could, well, leave us with something for us. So how, maybe the question's something like, how can we work with our own experiences of suffering on whatever level to transform them, well, ideally into that sort of freedom that you've just described?
Yeah, in some ways I don't think I can give a specific prescription. All I would say is come to the LBC, do your mindfulness of breathing, your metta bhavana, do practice devotion and study. I think study especially is really important, because through study you get... in a way, I think part of the function of study is to get some slogans, almost, to put it like that. Some little nutty, is that the right word? Little
pithy,
thank you. Pithy nuggets that, you know, usually when you choose them, you may not know why. You know, you don't know why something leaps out at you, but something in you knows better than you do, so to speak. So you need to be constantly provisioning yourself with dhammic reflections, which then link up with your own immediate experience and whatever your preoccupations are. So on this retreat, I had various preoccupations, which I then learned to trust. It's as if I would be interested in something and it had some meaning that I couldn't really follow, like reading about my nephew's explorations of genealogy. It had actually something to do with discovering the extent to which I'm actually just a bundle of conditions, most of which created genetically and family culturally, as it were, and social culturally. So the things that you start to get interested in have a significance that your dhammic reflection connects with. Then I got fascinated by the sense of the world in which I was living in Wales, had an immediate past, the Talwytheg, any Welsh here, the fair folk, what the Anglo-Saxons call the fairies, but, you know, these other beings who dwell in Anun, the other world, and have interaction with the human realm, began to be much more aware of that the world around me is alive, and began to be aware of the Neolithic and Bronze Age culture that was visible on the hilltops all around me. And so a much stronger sense of, yes, the landscape around me is a living landscape, and as peopled by consciousnesses other than mine own. And that then put me in connection with the sense that that how can I put this? What I am is not different from everything else around me. That there's a complete seamless connection between the life in everything around me and the life in me, and that I can flow with that, and I'm not separate from it. So if you've got a dharmic thread, that is a thread of conceptually based reflection, which comes from your Dhamma study, reading, and so on, which I would often just open a Dhamma book, the book of the moment, as it were, and I'd be able to read no more than a paragraph or sometimes a sentence, and that was enough. And then everything else constellates around that, and its meaning permeates everything else, and turns itself into a deeper and deeper experience. So yes, I would simply say, really make sure you're studying the Dhamma every day. Just a few drops of Dhamma go a very long way. Dhamma is homeopathic. The minutest, what do they call it, distillation of Dhamma is capable of transforming the world. And go with not just what you do in your study, in your formal study, but with what really appeals to you. Make sure it really is Dhamma and not some cod Dhamma that's off the latest spirituality shelf. But, you know, real, hardcore, neat Dhamma, not diluted. Make sure you get a good, stiff dose of Dhamma, not Dhamma light, which I believe is spelled L-I-T-E for some unearthly reason. And just make sure that's constantly drip-fed into your own mind. A bit of Dhammapada every day keeps the doctor away. And then, you know, if you're alive, you're thinking. If you're alive, you're reflecting. If you're alive, you're imagining. So there's imaginative connections being made all around you. And if you've got the Dhamma underlying all that, they all link up around the Dhamma. So that's my prescription.
Thank you.
Go and do it.
Yeah, thank you very, very much, Sabuti.
Yeah.
So, and thank you all for being this, receivers of that. So, that's very, very rich beginning to
I'm waiting for the frank revelations.
Well, maybe
tomorrow. Maybe tomorrow. Yeah.
Yeah, so do come for the next two nights, and also please do say this evening. So this evening we have got Dharma Night, where we're exploring the White Lotus Sutra themes from. So everyone's welcome to stay for Dharma Night. Everyone's welcome, more than welcome, to come tomorrow evening and the next evening for the next two conversations with Sabuti. But let's just thank Sabuti very, very much.